This morning, I'd like to talk about the one who is not busy. I've recently written a book on this topic called The One Who Is Not Busy, Connecting with Work in a Deeply Satisfying Way. And since I haven't had a job for years, you might wonder how acquainted I am with this topic. For starters, I was too busy to write this book. Gibb Smith, the publisher in Layton, Utah, came to a Tassara workshop I did a couple of years ago on this topic, time and busyness. And he asked me to write this book while he was at the workshop. But you know, I forgot about it, and time went on, and then one day he called and gave me a deadline. And so I realized that I was going to have to write the book in the spaces between my regular work, which is traveling around to give talks and having retreats, and seeing students. This is what I do. And I realized that I was going to have to to meet the deadline, I was going to have to write this book in the unstructured time around those activities. Time when I'm having tea with my friends, or reading, or, you know, talking, or walking in the park, or the various things that I do. But the trouble is, if I do that, then I become very grumpy and tired, and I can't concentrate anyway. I mean, that time is extremely restorative to me. In fact, I used to schedule it just as seriously as my structured time. But I realized I would have to do this. So what I had to do to finish the book by the deadline was what I'm about to preach to you. Namely, totally submerge myself in not busy while madly and desperately working. So the reason I wrote this book is because, first of all, I've been giving stress reduction workshops in hospitals for years in the Bay Area, but also over the years from the dot-com boom on, my home temple became, after I left Green Gulch years ago, it became the city center. That's where dot-com people went during the boom. And so in private interviews, I would hear these horror stories about taking sleeping bags to work and having to do this until the first million was made, which eventually these people were released from that burden. But at the time, it was very serious business, figuring out how to live a life of any quality at all when you were making your first million. And people brought terrible conflicts, not just dot-comers, but people who came to see me brought conflicts, and this has continued to this day, the conflicts between working and family life, and any emotional sustenance, any taking care of the body, raising kids, having a family. People have terrible conflicts about these things. And sometimes it's just as simple as greed, which is that you just want to do everything. You know, here's your job, and instead of just working, you know, while you're at your job, you want to, you know, do somebody else's job too. Or sometimes you have to. You don't have a choice. Downsizing, and to keep your job, you're doing two or three people's jobs. And then, you want to do civic things. You want to be an activist, a political activist. You want to raise your kids, and you want to raise them in a certain way, which means that you're driving them to lessons and stuff like that. And you want to, you know, your friend's giving an art show, another friend is reading poetry, and you want to read the anyway, you know what I'm talking about. It's simple greed in some cases. for myself, it's almost entirely that. And then another reason that people suffer over this is not being clear about priorities. Accepting, which just is big in our culture right now, accepting as a paradigm for happiness, just that agreeable little blip of pleasure you get when you check something off your to-do list, thinking that's the whole thing. So that you want to work steadily so you can make those check marks. And, you know, it's years sometimes before people figure out that's not a life. And another thing that people get caught up in, because it's part of our culture, is working to acquire things. And again, that agreeable little blip when you purchase the new car or the beautiful house. I mean, this can be a little longer blip than the check mark, but it's basically it's a blip when you talk about happiness. So getting caught up in acquisitiveness and not questioning, all my kids have to go to private school, I have to have a house of this many square, not questioning that kind of thing, just doing what it takes to put that in place. That's just a matter of not assigning priorities. You know, what's important in your life? So we actually have to know enough about ourselves that we can make those decisions. What makes me happy? You have to actually know something. If you just go along with the culture, that's misleading for a lot of people. So we have to know what it is that we really want in order to assign priorities. And then, more often than not, this conflict over what's important is a matter of developing the skill to focus our attention at will. And this is what I want to talk about today. Over the years that I've been working with people who have been faced with a variety of crises, professional, emotional, physical, I have come to believe that one of life's most essential skills is the ability to focus the attention at will. This single ability is the foundation of all mastery and all contentment. We can't talk about developing talent or facing catastrophe until that skill is in place. For instance, I work with people in chronic pain. If people in chronic pain don't have that skill, because pain is such a tremendously powerful object of consciousness, if you don't develop the skill to focus your attention at will, pain will always hijack your consciousness, all the way from a little ache to, you know, over crippling pain. It will always hijack your consciousness if you don't get the skill in place. So it's the cornerstone of any adjustment to catastrophe. We create ourselves by how we invest our attention. So if we want to practice in every aspect of our lives, if we want to integrate compassion and mindfulness into deadlines and productivity, if we want to have a feeling of being used well by others and potent to ourselves, then it behooves us to learn the skills that we need to focus and sustain attention. If we don't assert our attention now in our culture, if we don't assert our attention and our own values into our workday, then the fallback position in our culture right now is acquisition and speed. If you don't assert your own values into your workplace, if you don't take a stand to yourself, then you'll just be swept up in the acquisition and greed. That's the major thing happening in workplaces right now. Rush, 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 get. You have to be clear about what you're going to focus on. So basically, there are two approaches to establishing this skill. Two basic approaches to creating a well-paced and a spacious life amid the pressures and the complexities of our workplaces now. The first approach is to take a break. You can be driven by time and deadlines most of the time and then come up for air by taking a break. The second approach is the Zen practice of simultaneous inclusion. You can be busy and not busy at the same time. So first, taking a break. This is conceptually very simple. You work, you stop working. There's no big conceptual thing about it. We all think we know how to do this because it is conceptually so simple. Looking up from our desk, and just if you have a window in your office, looking out the window, this relaxes the neck muscles, clears the space just by focusing widely rather than at the computer or down at your desk. And then less than a second maybe, and then back down. That's a very big break. Or taking a day off of unstructured time every week, like the Jewish Sabbath. I found out that the Jewish Sabbath was just for that reason. You work 6 days a week, and then there's one day where you change mode. You change mode. Instead of gaining or losing world, you're in being world. And that, I think, is a very good idea. Or sitting a 5 to 30 day meditation retreat periodically, soaking in a long hot tub, or having some sort of mindfulness practice in which whenever this thing that you've decided comes up, you just stop and settle, taking a breath or looking into the horizon, whatever. Like for me, for years, it was a ringing telephone, because that's a good space to cultivate. You hear the phone ring, and I'm doing this, why don't they leave me alone, blah, blah, blah. Stop, breathe, and then when you answer the phone, you're totally there for the person who called. We all are familiar with people answering the phone and saying, hello. So this is very different to turn your attention toward a caller, or other people whenever they turn a doorknob, that's another way to do it, or walk through a doorway, stop. You're entering a new environment when you do those things. So this is conceptually clear, this first approach, taking a break. It's just difficult to do it. You just have to develop some discipline to do it, very much instituting a practice to be able to do this. Then the Zen practice of simultaneous inclusion is a little more demanding, but it's worth it. The reason I call this a Zen practice is because in Zen we practice excluding nothing, acknowledging the truth that everything is present simultaneously all the time. So our meditation, Zazen, our particular form of Zen meditation, is the practice of perceiving emptiness at the same time that we perceive form. We watch everything arise in Zazen. You're not concentrated on a single thing. It's kind of a panoramic awareness. So you watch whatever arise, but it's always seen against a background of emptiness because you understand that it's going to go away. It arose, it passes away. Something else arises, passes away. Then that same thing comes back, passes away, and so on. So you're always perceiving the form or the ideas or the thing, the thought, against a background of emptiness in this particular form of meditation. It's a profound acknowledgement of seeing stuff out there, out of these eyes, or in the mind, and simultaneously that you see the stuff, you understand that we're not separate from it. It's all in our minds. It's all in our minds. So I think it's a very profound form of meditation, Zazen is. So how can we be busy and not busy at the same time? By focusing on the distinction the form world, like we always do, this world in which I see individual faces and walls and Buddhas and lamps and sticks and pages. Focusing on the distinction, like we usually do, the difference between this job and that, this person and that. But we should also be able to discern the flow, the unmediated experience of our activity, as well as the distinction. So meditation helps us tremendously with the ability to perceive the flow itself, the experience itself. If we move beyond our categories, we're always putting things in category. Oh, nice pants, nice whatever. If we move beyond the categories of everything we do, our lives take on a flowing, non-dual quality. We don't have to divide our activity up into mental categories that don't serve us. For instance, in our work life, consequential, trivial. That may not serve us if we have to do the trivial thing anyway. Only when we're prioritizing does that distinction serve us. When we're actually doing, it doesn't serve us anymore. So we could stop chopping our time, our work life, into stress-producing shards of distinctions like urgent, dispensable, superficial, deep, engrossing, boring. If we don't divide our activity up this way, then every task we do is inherently valuable, just because we're doing it, just because our attention is on it. That's why it's inherently valuable. So if we're totally intent on what we're doing right now, every movement of it, every action, and everything we say is an expression of our full being, our full attention right then. Right what we're doing. And also our values in honoring our full attention, in honoring the thing that we're doing. For instance, let's say you're a high-powered lawyer, but before you leave in the morning, you have to make your kids lunch. So the tendency, or what is encouraged in our culture, is that you slap the lunch together, throw an apple and the lunch and a Hostess Twinkie or whatever in a bag, hand it to the kid and run to your real life, park the car, you know, rush over to the courthouse, and then before you open the courthouse door, you settle, you're present, you walk in, you're alive. That's the conventional way to do that. But what if you thought your kid's lunch was as important, or the movements you're doing during the lunch are as important as the movements you're doing in the courthouse, or the things you say in the trial? Then, and I'm not talking about slow here, I'm talking about a normal pace. It has nothing to do with slow or fast. You open the two pieces of bread. You got the peanut butter and jelly right there. You put a big glob of peanut butter on one piece of bread, but because you're paying attention, you move the peanut butter all the way to the edge of the bread. All the way. And when you put on jelly, same thing. The jelly and peanut butter ratio, jelly peanut butter bread ratio, is perfect. Every bite that kid takes will be full of the required ingredients. And you've got the bag right there, so you put the Hostess Twinkie in a separate little bag, the apple, a napkin, you've got it right there from the night before. You roll up the bag. What? 1 second? Hand it to the kids, so there are side effects, and then you go on to the courthouse. There are side effects of paying this kind of attention. Namely, when the kid opens his lunch, he knows that he's loved, that he wasn't just an also-ran in your activity that day. So this is not assigning separate values, but everything you do is full of your full attention. So, we also, if we're able to dip into the flow as well as make distinctions, we also don't have to be concerned over whose time we're on. The boss's time at work, the kids' time at home. So many of us are resentful that we never have time for ourselves. But when you pay full attention to things, that's your time. It's all our time. We realize that it's all our time when we start making these arbitrary divisions in what is actually a seamless expanse of time and activity. So then we call this going back between the form world, the diverse world, and a task is either important or trivial, and a non-dualistic understanding, going back and forth between that and a non-dualistic understanding, or the flow of the whole thing, we call this perceiving form and emptiness. In Zen, we emphasize the presence of both the empty realm and the form realm in everything that we do. Form is the world we're used to dealing with. Emptiness is the understanding that the way we divide things up is totally dependent on our intention at the time. You bring down Manjushri's sword and say, important, trivial. Manjushri sword, good, bad. It's all based on what you're doing right then. You have the power. In the dot-com days, when people were complaining about taking their sleeping bags to work, I said, stay focused on your decision. It's your decision. It's not your boss torturing you or your coworkers stigmatizing you for wanting an hour for lunch. It's your decision to stay in the situation. And it's the same wherever you bring down the sword is based on your reality at that moment. We're all in this room together. And yet, so it's the same environment, but yet each of us is looking at it from a different angle. Each of us has a different priority. Some people are listening to me, some people are sleeping, some people are hearing birds, some people are thinking about the problems that they left this morning in their house, some people are thinking about what they're going to do later, some people are hoping there are cookies, some people are... So we're constructing of this room our own reality. We're bringing down, intentionally or not, and believe me, it's best if it's intentional. We're bringing down the sword and saying, this is important right now and this is not. So to be aware that you have a lot of control over that, whatever situation you're in. And when a manager looks at his office as units of production coming together to meet a projected goal, he looks at it all in that broad sense, then one of these units of production, an office worker, is looking at her workload and the number of hours she has to do it. So she's looking more of a microcosm. And then maybe the office temp looks around and decides who's an attractive marriage partner. So everybody's looking from their own point of view at the same thing. So you can perceive any of these points of view that I just mentioned in this room now if you get into your experience itself, the flow itself. Then it's not broken up. All of it kind of weaves together simultaneously. You can listen to birds and be kind of sleepy and hear my words come in and out and kind of yearn for a cookie all at the same time. You just get into the experience itself, the flow itself. And this is how you get into busy, not busy. It's exactly how you do it. So if you abide exclusively in the work world, in the workday world, and have no familiarity with tuning into your direct experience, it's all up in the head, it's deadlines and units of work and so on, you never drop down into your experience itself. So if this is your entire reality, then your whole life is goal-oriented. It's about meeting goals. It's a series of unending chores and demands. This is stuck in the form realm. On the other hand, if you vastly prefer to hang out in sensation, in pleasurable sensations, undifferentiated attention, remote from suffering, and uninvolved in everyday life, you're not attached to anything. That's the upside, or maybe the downside simultaneously, but you can't take care of your life, you can't take care of your sick mom, you can't support your kids. So this is getting stuck in emptiness, in the empty world, and we should get stuck anywhere for more emptiness. If you succeed in simultaneously including both points of focus, whether you're floating away or lying on the beach, you can go back and forth between the different points of view as they serve you, or perceive them simultaneously. Oh, there's a seagull. Wonder what kind it is. I'll look up on the book, in the book, while I'm lying here on the beach soaking up the sun. You can easily go back and forth. If you can't, train it. So, from an activity point of view, there's... What time do I stop?
11:15.
Oh, okay. I won't go that long, don't worry. So, from an activity point of view, there's no difference between our work and lunchtime. We eat lunch with the same kind of absorption and attention that we work. Being at home, being at work, and being at home, same thing. Our children, our spouse, and our leisure get the same kind of attention that our work does. And as far as, you know, spacing out, you know, often if people have a very intense day and then they go home and they want not to focus on anything, you can give not focusing on anything the same sort of attention you give focusing on things. This is hard to talk about, but everybody here knows what I mean. So everything is simultaneously included at the same time. You just direct your focus toward one or another. It's all available. Everything I've mentioned is available to all of us. It's just intention, focusing on this, then that. So with such an attitude, we don't have to wait for enlightenment. It colors our every breath, informs our every breath. So for each of us individually then, the practical question becomes, how do we live our lives to simultaneously include form and emptiness in any one activity? How do we do it? So in my book, I offer specific meditations to develop the skill of simultaneous inclusion. Over the years, I really love traditional meditation, but I also like to play around with meditation. So I've developed some things too. I'm sure I'm not the only one. So the kind of meditations that for this training that I've put in the book are, first of all, and very basically, taking refuge in the body. Taking refuge in the body. The body is a great refuge from frantic activity. Because even though you have a big deadline and a mortgage to pay, your body basically doesn't care. Your body, on the contrary, actually gets restless and irritated by your anxieties. It would much rather be pumping blood and stretching its muscles. It has no interest at all in your coworker's snits or the promotion you're working towards. Because of this, because of its inherent equanimity and willingness to be with whatever is. That's your body, inherently willing to be in most situations with whatever is. It's an extremely reliable place to go for solace and for peace. And a great big advantage is that it's here. You don't have to drag equipment around. It's here. So when you start getting wound up and anxious, you can include your body's point of view in your anxiety. I didn't say obliterate your anxiety or whatever you're concerned about. People get scared to leave their anxiety because it's kind of a flashpoint, you know. Oh, what if I don't think about how anxious I am? I won't get anything done. You don't have to leave that. Just include your body's point of view. So you can drop into its sensations in a heartbeat. And you can come out and go back to your anxiety in a heartbeat. So it's refreshing to do that. To just be right here. I can feel my rear end on this bench. I can feel the actual weight of my robe on my shoulders. It's very grounding. I'm quite frightened of public speaking. And when I feel the weight of my robes on my shoulders, I feel very august with all this material. So I settle, and I'm comfortable talking to you when that's what I feel. So other meditations that I've mentioned, because it's important that you see form and emptiness, that you actually see the focuses that you're dealing with here. So I have in the book a wandering mind meditation where instead of pulling yourself back to breath as the major thing in a single focused meditation, you, whenever you go somewhere, you pull yourself back. But in what I call the wandering mind meditation, you actually notice where you go. That's the main focus. And then you come back to breath. But the main thing is to notice where you go. All these forms, all these lists that you make, all the scraps of song or recall of yesterday's events or whatever comes up for you. That's the form world. So you notice, oh, these are my favorite forms. And then I do a walking meditation in my workshops, which I've included in the book, that has different objects of focus as you walk around. First, you start out in your body, then, you know, how many steps per breath, then you go on to, you know, everything you hear, just be hearing, then feel everything that's on your skin. So you're in the same environment, but you're shifting your attention constantly for a concentrated, short concentrated period of time. And when you do this, then you see emptiness. You've got the same forms here, and you just see them come, steps, breath, and go. Now what comes is attention to sound. That goes. So you see the emptiness of your attention. And then I end up with people picking out what they love or what they hate about the environment that they're in, then what they love. So we go from body through senses to opinion. And you just see it's all, I mean, people say to me when we do this in workshops, I just can't believe it. I think the same thing is ugly and beautiful. You know, the emptiness of that projection. Emptiness meaning that it's all coming from you. That thing itself is innocent. That thing itself is innocent. So it's very interesting then to see emptiness, to perceive that it's all coming from you. And then I have some meditations to integrate the two. Simultaneously, I love to do talking meditations with people, asking them to perceive the person that they're having a conversation with, and also to focus on breath. So there has to be some way. It's very clunky at first. People go back and forth like a strobe effect. You know, me, you, me, you, me, you. But if you practice this enough, it's simultaneous. My breath intermingles with your words, intermingles with the emotions I have, intermingles with my trying to impress you, intermingles with your pulling on me emotionally. You know, all the things that happen between people just start weaving together, and that's it. That's simultaneous inclusion. So Gibb Smith, the publisher, asked me during the workshop at Tassajara, he said, is simultaneous inclusion enlightenment? So I said, Gibb's dog, if you've got simultaneous inclusion, you don't need enlightenment. It's a full, rich life. So awareness of this flow, of this deep source of energy and peace, allows us to see our lives as a simple flow of activity from the time you get up. Not necessarily broken up into separate parts, separate pursuits and tasks, although we do have to do that to prioritize our day. So it's not necessarily broken up that way. You just break it up when you need to or want to. So when we're aware of not only having a goal and an end time for our work, but also of our sensations, we're aware of our sensations, our perceptions, and our physical motions in doing the work, then there's kind of a flexible, flowing feeling to our whole day, no matter how much we have to do to get done by the end of it. So rather than experiencing our work as a series of annoying transitions, work phone, work email, you can just have, instead of feeling interrupted. Now, interrupted is when you cling to something. When it's a flow, then it's just leave that and take up. This is how multitasking really works, by the way. Our problem with multitasking is that we're usually focused on what we're not doing instead of what we are doing in multitasking. All you have to do is focus on what you're actually doing while you're doing something else. And so you focus, you go around and focus, and over time you develop the skill to shift. That's a skill, shifting your full attention from thing to thing rapidly. That's a skill that you have to develop. Full attention. Full attention. Full attention. This doesn't come naturally. You have to train this sort of thing. And that's the instruction in the book. So rather than feeling like you're being interrupted again and again, instead, our work days begin to have a seamless quality because we're focused on action itself, on our movements itself, and then all its components, the sensuality of it, the physicality of it, the thoughts, the intellectual parts of it. So our various faculties and talents surface as they're needed. Our assorted chores and projects are not valued in terms of how boring or urgent or empowering they are. Your day should consist of all these things: empowerment, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of disappointment, just so you don't get too inflated. If you're paying attention to the flow, then all these things come forward. So our days are not valued from the point of view of breaking it up exclusively. But each thing that we do gets our full attention in turn. So when we wake up in the morning, we dip our hands into a river of activity and responsibility. When we stop for the evening, we lift our hands out of the river and let them rest. So it's all the river flowing toward the sunset, and it will deliver us into our beds. So the great Zen master Dogen said, realization is effort without desire. Realization is effort without desire. And when we understand, fully understand, that we are happiest giving everything our full attention without concern for the outcome, effort without desire. We love giving things our full attention. It's satisfying to us without concern for the outcome. When we understand this, we've had a great insight into the human heart. With this attitude, any work or job we do is meaningful. We're our activity itself, cultivating the doing of work for its own sake, totally immersed in the feelings and the movements of what we do, supporting the flow of life. So the one who is not busy is always there, waiting for us to notice, and is always ready to brush our cheeks, aware of the breeze. So being exactly here, giving our activity, our whole heart and being. And this is, of course, our greatest challenge. This is not easy, what I'm talking about. It's just a worthwhile way to live your life. It's not easy. So it's our greatest challenge, but it's also, as far as I can tell in my life, it's also our deepest satisfaction. Thank you very much. Being in place is the fruit of the Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Visions are inexhaustible. I vow to save them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.